It's time for the creative people to make money. You know, the creative people have spent 30 years on stage doing stand-up comedy before they got discovered. Not saying they deserve to be rich overnight, but like we're entering an era of where the creative people has never had a better opportunity to not be a slave for 30 years.
For me, it's that passion and that belief, you know, if I'm hiring someone for my team in social media, that they actually care and are a fan of the material and believe in what I'm doing. That is so pinnacle. And then it's quickly the humility. I look for humility, understanding that you know very, very little, and understanding that you'll be wrong, and the having the open-mindedness and the willingness to change. Thanks for coming on, man.
Good to see you.
Oh, now we're both styling.
Mine are reading glasses. Like, I can't see my screen.
When I see technical analysis, we've got a lot of views on technical analysis. Some say it's the astrology, right, for young men. How do you use technical analysis to make money?
If you get right to what technical analysis is, it's, for me, it's pattern recognition. And it really breaks down human behavior, right? Looking at a piece, looking at a chart is much like looking at Mona Lisa. It's a work of art every moment in time because it's an accumulation of what everybody who's thinking about that stock and pushing a button to buy and sell. That's an expression of how the world feels at that moment. It's really an amazing thing. But at the same time, it means nothing. So it means everything and it means nothing because everything went into getting you that piece of data. But unless you read it, unless you know how to read it, it could be a weapon of mass destruction. So mm-hmm. depending on who's reading it. So it really means nothing because it only means something if you were right and then it's self-fulfilling. But what an incredible piece of data to have the price and volume relative to where the price and volume was years ago or a week ago or a month ago. So it really is in the eye of the beholder. What I call it chart art, and that just, you know, if people say I'm using technical analysis, I go, no, I call it chart art. These are pieces of art in a moment of time, much like AI. And it's how you look at it. And so the more art I look at, the better eye I will get for seeing patterns, right? And paint by numbers is how you start with painting, and they're numbers. And you fill it in, and all of a sudden you go, oh, okay. And so charts are just about how do I look at the world and how do other people look at the world? And predicting where the line goes next, we could argue all day about that. But I feel that since the greatest companies in the world and the biggest frauds in the world, charts look the same over time,
right,
that there has to be something to technical now. Somebody knew something. And so I'm not going to dismiss technical analysis as voodoo because the people that read it right have a skill.
Are you using this as a way to get in and out? Are you starting with a fundamental, you know, assessment? Hey, I like this company. I like this stock for this reason. Let's see what the chart looks like to see if that confirms or denies or refutes my thesis. Or are you starting with, I don't give a shit. I'm just looking at I'm a pure chartist where I'm just looking at the way things look on paper. Or on your screen.
Yeah, I'm not a pure chart. It doesn't interest me. But I do follow people that are pure chartists because they've done the work for me. So this is why I started StockTwits. Is like, and this is where AI is going to be super interesting in financial service. Not the AI itself, but what people are, who the people are that are looking at certain prompts. So again, like the future is going to be really interesting. Not that AI is cool, but like how do people using AI to pull information, who should I follow that's good at prompting? So for technical analysis, I just want to follow the people that have no opinion about it other than they're good at it. Meaning they have a history of like reading things and understanding the way price behavior works. So if I see that All-Star Charts or Kimball Charting or Ivanov or the people that I think do this for a living and really mostly look at charts, they're doing a lot of the work for me. I know how they think. So when they share a chart, it's worth me taking note. Then I will do my work. I can't own every stock, but like if an industry that I like fundamentally is in the top of my mind and then I see the chart people talking about it, that's good.
Right. Signal. You start paying attention.
Yeah, it's just paying attention. I can't be all places, but like you only need 5 or 10 good ideas in your lifetime to retire. And so best to get as many things lined up as possible. So if it means that I got to follow a chartist to get there, that's fine.
You listed off a few guys that I haven't, I haven't heard of. Who's your sort of heroes in charting right now that people can take a look at?
Unless I'm on Twitter or Stockus, but I love Helene Meisler. She's like an old pro. I've had her on my podcast. She's way back in the street.com days. She was a Goldman Sachs' first technical analyst. She's just great. She's just a pro. Then there's JC, who's a student. Well, there's Jeffrey DeGraff, who was like a master. He was at Lehman and everywhere. I think he has his own firm now, DeGraff. And he used to just do these incredible, like, thick-lined, like, so obvious to everybody. Like, he wasn't, like, squiggly lines. He was just like, here's, like, with a big black marker, you go, it's like, you got to be an idiot not to understand what's going on. He just took it to such a pure art level. And then, you know, the people that studied him, Jeff, JC at All-Star Charts is, I think, the best top-down thinker, non-emotional, but yeah, like good personality around all this. And then there's Ivanov, who I do a weekly show with, Momentum Monday. He's more a swing trader and just very unique way he thinks about, he just personally manages his own money and he's a swing trader and everything has to align technically the way he wants. And then there's Kimball Charting, who's amazing, Chris Kimball, who's been doing it for 100 years. And he just looks at the biggest pictures and draws fat lines too. So again, I don't like looking at the squiggly squigglies.
Right.
Because I don't want to stare at my computer all day. I got to keep it simple.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for big moves, patterns.
Okay. So charting is one of those areas where it's part of the decision-making process, not the decision-making process. And I think, you know, what I warn against, you know, I do funny skits and I do this podcast. I do a lot of different pieces of content. But what I warn against is if you're a young investor and you're a young trader, you want to make some money sitting at home in your underwear with 10 computer screens, just pulling up the charts is not going to be enough unless you end up becoming one of these rock star chartists who've been doing it, like you said, for 100 years. They've had so much contact with the market. It's almost like, you know, it's a sushi chef who they can see how they cut that piece of tuna a little off, but you can't see it, right? It's it's an incredible amount of experience that, of course, takes real dollars and years to earn and to cut your teeth. So charting, I think while it's extremely helpful, it has that allure of danger, because if you just say, hey, mom and dad, I can look at a few lines and draw this and look at the oscillating, moving average, I'll be right. And of course, you know, young traders and young folks sitting at home, they can get rocked pretty hard in these types of decision-making patterns.
Listen, if my kids do it, not charting, but there's the easiest way to invest is to index. I'm 58 years old and I now almost believe fully in indexing, but because it works.
Indexing like S&Ps, Vanguard,
yeah,
S&Ps?
S&P and QQQ. Like, okay. I believe that it works. It works. I'm not going to get into why or why not. It's just the market. If there was no index, I wouldn't, you know, we don't know, but we have years and years of study that indexing is pretty good. If you want to get market returns, that's the Vanguard S&P 500, lowest fees. Okay. You want to try and beat it, now it's a whole different game. Now, there's a million ways to try and beat it. And my new thesis is don't pick stocks, unpick stocks, right? Like, instead of, like, picking 10 stocks, why don't you just take 2 stocks out of the S&P, right? Do all your work and just take 2 stocks out. And at least if you're wrong, you're still going to be basically the S&P. But if you're right, you actually were an active manager, and I took out Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs because I hate bankers. And I want to fucking support these guys. And guess what? You can go to bed at night and go, you know what? I didn't support those scumbags. And if I'm right and banking stocks underperform for the next 20 years, which I think they will, then at least also you beat the S&P. You may only beat it by 10 basis points a year, but you were actively stock picking.
Yeah.
And you can feel good about yourself. So that's the next phase that's coming to the
market. I love
markets.
That, dude.
That's coming.
I love that.
Yeah. So I believe that's almost like direct indexing. So I call it unpicking. Like before you pick a stock, why don't you learn to unpick? We all know which companies we hate. You may hate Fox. You may hate Philip Morris. You may hate Wells Fargo. You may hate Gold. There is a company out there that Exxon. You can be an ESG investor by taking out one company and actually be a stock picker and go to sleep at night knowing that you're not going to underperform or outperform by that much. And you got your market risk. Everybody's doing it wrong. What pisses me off about Vanguard is, not that it's not genius, is that it's so corrupt. Let's think about the corrupt. And this is where kids should learn to unpick versus picking. We hate Wells Fargo. How much fraud have JP Morgan and Wells Fargo committed? How many billions in legal fees have these companies paid and screwed us over?
It's just a line item for them at this point, right?
It's a line item. Okay. So Betty Lou in the middle of, she may hate them, but her 401k has S&P 500. So she hates them. And every month when she puts money in her IRA, she's supporting them without even understanding it. And JP Morgan can do whatever the hell they want because every dollar that gets put in Vanguard S&P 500, a fraction of that goes to JP Morgan. So no matter how bad their behavior is, right? So the first thing we need to teach kids is to unpick, meaning there are tools out there and being built that allow you to own the S&P 500 and deselect the 10 companies. So let's uncomplicate things. Don't try and pick 10 ESG planetary good companies. How about you pretty much have a good instinct enough to find two of the most evil companies that you can think of and at least deselect them so that your money does not support their bad. Vote with your wallet. Okay.
Bad behavior, or you just don't buy into their thesis or how they're running their business. Yeah.
And here's how you should pick companies. Not technically, but like every 10-year-old knows already which companies they live with every day, whether it be McDonald's or Tesla or Netflix or, you know, Facebook, whatever those six or seven, I call them 8 to 80 companies. You don't need technical analysis to know that the company Google, that 8-year-olds use Google and 80-year-olds use Google. So find those companies that you live with, that you know your grandparents live with too, and own those companies. You don't need to do any technical analysis. Oh, and by the way, you could be technical and say, I'm going to put a watch list together. When I see my 10 favorite companies 8 days in a row red, I'll buy them. Not 8 days in a row green. So you can set up little technical tricks in your head to like behaviorally teach yourself to invest by saying, hey, you know what? If I see red forever and ever, that's a good thing. And if I see green forever and ever, maybe it's time to just sell a little bit. So you can be a trader without really being a trader, just using a very simple green-red formula. And you don't need 10 screens. You just need a Robinhood account or whatever brokerage you want on your phone. And just learn to read fear and greed. And now you're a trader. But you don't need charts and any of this other stuff. You need your eyes to know what, and your ears and your dollar and what you're spending your money on to know. Mm-hmm. So I think those are the things we got to teach kids. The good news about the last 10 years is we onboarded this next generation to this idea. The bad news is they're not getting the proper education about how easy this is. It can be as hard as hell. But it also can be pretty easy if you start with the right basic.
Do you know why all the get-rich-quick books fail? They enforce a map that worked for the author that won't work for you. Why are you learning about digital ads when you'd prefer to set up a booth at a trade show and learn from customers face-to-face? Why are you reading about dropshipping when you're passionate about music? See what I'm saying? My book, The Entrepreneur's Field Guide, provides the tools for you to make your own map so you could feel more connected to your work, make money doing something you enjoy, and give back to the people you care about most. I wrote this field guide not only from my own life experience, but from interviewing top entrepreneurs weekly on my podcast. With the tools in the field guide, you simply can't fail. You'll learn about intelligent pivoting, or what I call iteration, why you already have a multi-million dollar idea in your head, and why you can ignore every hot market you think will make you money so you could focus on the things that you actually enjoy. Or as I like to say, it's not never give up. It's never give up iterating on things you like until something works. Get the Entrepreneur's Field Guide right now at nicholascrown.com. Okay, now back to the show. I mean, I really like the idea of using anecdotal you know, your actual contact with the world and products and services and whatever to say, hey, you know, this is the product that I'm using, not that one. And my friends aren't using that product yet. That stock is rich compared to this stock. So I can do a little pair trade here, or I could just decide to deselect that other one from my index, my, you know, Nick Crown index, you know, and this is a lot of fun. Also, you benefit from diversification automatically in this method, right? You've got a basket of stocks, and you take out the dogs, so to speak.
Is it?
Goddamn, that's a good idea, man.
Occasionally, I have good ideas.
It's not bad, Howard. Not bad. I mean, so I'm like.
One day I'll be able to finish my house if I have enough good ideas. I'll be able to finish my house. I'm homeless.
Yeah. So if you guys are watching this on YouTube or whatever, and you see wires sticking out of the wall, Howard's doing some complete. Is this a gut renovation? Is a brand new house?
We're in Coronado. We spend our time in Phoenix and Coronado, San Diego, and we had a leak. Our house has slipped up. So last year, unfortunately, we had a leak in the house, and the whole house, the floors and everything, kitchen got destroyed.
Oh man!
So we're in the middle of finishing the fix. It's closer than it looks, but it looks terrible right now.
it looks like, you know, you'll get there eventually. I'm a thematic investor, so where I pointed my, because my biggest return is my own products and services. So a lot of my money goes back into my own machine as opposed to someone next door, you know, looking at Google over here, going to Google or going wherever next door. So I invest in EV and EV technology. That's just something I got interested in. And I realized that I'm doing something, this unselecting that you've just discussed, because there's a handful of businesses that I'll invest in and specific EVs that I think are high risk. And there's a specific EV manufacturer that I wouldn't touch with a 100-foot pole, and for reasons of my own, you know, my own research, you know, not reading online, but saying, you know, the background of the CEO doesn't really match up with someone that's, I think, is going to perform in this industry. And so that was the poor. I didn't short the stock. I just didn't add it into my thematic basket. And that has proven to be really, really beneficial. Of course, I'm getting hammered on some of the big names, but I'm more than making up for it with some of the folks that supply. So South Korea, chip manufacturers, Panasonic, you know, folks that supply all the EV tech. Those stocks have, I mean, the Panasonic SDR that I own is up 40%. That's more than made up for the, you know, the sluggishness of the big dogs like Tesla. So I think it's a great idea, and it's something that you're gonna put a boundary on your highs and lows. You're gonna be diversified. It's a lot safer than playing the fucking thousand sided die game of picking a stock.
I mean, the great news is there's a million ways to do it, and I think it's like your DNA. Everybody's gonna have a different risk profile. I don't think we've done it. Another idea that I'm working on, or telling, I'm too old to work on new things, but I tell entrepreneurs that ask me, you know, they pitch me, and I go, you know what would work. And so the unpicking is something that I'm fascinated by, you know. The other thing that I think would work is everybody has a sleep score. Everybody has, like, their fucking Fitbit that they wear, and they know, sure, how many heartbeats per minute and whatever they should. No one has a wrist. No one's come up with a wrist score, right, where people can wear proudly on their chest, right? Everybody's scared to tell people, like, everybody, you know, am I a degenerate? Like, I don't want to be seen as a degenerate. What's wrong with being a degenerate? Like, the point is, you've got to know your risk profile so that you can find other people. So you can either match yourself with people of the opposite risk profile, right, to manage your money, or, you know, you really need to understand yourself, because we all were born under different conditions. We had different type of things, traumatic, happen in our life that shape how we think about risk. And so the first thing no one's doing is, like, what is my risk score? You sign up for a brokerage account, they ask you, like, five stupid questions that's been generally accepted. But, like,
for 100 years, they're asking you the same fucking questions.
Yeah, same thing with skiing. Are you a beginner, intermediate? I mean, there's such subtlety to what your level is.
Right.
And same with risk scores. So I really believe that investors should be answering questions constantly so that they can have a risk score. You know, if I'm very risk averse, I'm a 10. But I could be a 15. And if I'm a gunslinger, I could be a 90 or 85. Like, there are subtleties to that. And I think we haven't figured out, it's being ashamed of it. And, you know, and starting stock twits, I see this all the time, right? Like, it's so funny. I see people talking about Apple all day, but I know if I saw their portfolio, it would have biotech stocks in it and pennies. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, right.
Because they're ashamed, right? And the reason I love pseudonymous like Twitter and then I started StockTwits is I don't care what your name is or what you look like. I just want to hear what your ideas. And the more you tell me, like, I don't need to know your name and see a picture of you. I could know so much about you by like what you invest in and how you think about risk. And that's all that matters in the financial world is like, I don't care if you're 600 pounds or black or white or whatever your sexual, I just need to know your idea and how you think. And I think pseudonymous was perfect for that's why Reddit and StockTwits and Twitter are so popular amongst, because you don't have to use your real name, right? Mm. And if your ideas are good, I don't care. I don't care if you're pseudonymous. If you're sharing great ideas, I'm following you, right? And so I think people need to understand that, like pseudonymous, like be whoever you want in the financial world, but use these products and then be honest about what your risk profile is so that you can get the most out of these. Like, you know, and so I think there's a lot to be done in that space as well. And, you know, if I'm an 80, I want to, maybe I only want to talk to 20s, because, you know, I need to temper down my risk. Or if I'm an 80, I just want to hang out with other 80s. And at least I know they're 80s, so everything is under the context of this guy's a lunatic. Mm-hmm. And I just think we're at the early days of this type of behavioral study. Because, you know, other than like using your eyes and ears to and your wallet to understand how you're spending and how you see the world, behavior is the next thing that you gotta master.
One thing that I'm picking up here, though, is while it's great to engage and to discuss and to learn, it's not great to copy and ape. What you're saying is when you're talking to the 20s and the 80s, if we have this risk profile score, you're saying, I'm listening, but I'm not copying. I'm taking into consideration the way that you guys are thinking, and I'm amending my model. I'm amending my, you know, my strategy by talking to you and learning, not by copying. I think this is enormous.
I think it's enormous. Listen, I'm an investor in eToro, which has made a lot of money in the copy trading world and the rest of the world. Copy trading has never caught on in the U.S. for whatever reason. And basically because we have the S&P. If you're going to copy anything, copy an index and go backwards.
Yeah.
Copy the index, then take out one company that you just despise. You are now created your own unique, complete product on your own. That is amazing. And you can share that with your friends, and all your friends who want to invest and hate Wells Fargo too or Goldman Sachs can exact copy your portfolio. So I'm all for that. Like, you know, I'm all for people being able to copy. I just don't think it's the be all end all. I think if someone told you could learn Spanish in 10 minutes, it'd be cool. But like, is that how you really learn Spanish? You learn Spanish going and spending a summer or a year in Spain or Mexico. You're really going to enjoy it, you know? And you learn the markets, not by copying, but by like making mistakes, doing it yourself. And I think the most important language, which is why I spent most of my life here, because it's just such so much fun. It's a language. So learning the language of the markets and understanding your own behavior is going to, it's global. So you can go to Australia and the markets are there, right? Like you can go to Saudi Arabia, the markets are there. You can do this. If you learn the language of the markets, you can live your life independently forever. And I think that's what people were so excited about Bitcoin and, you know, digital assets. They got lost in the fact that like they still have to have value and they still have to have function. And they, you know what I mean? But it's okay. But like they didn't understand the language. They just got carried away with like the shiny object. But the it all still comes back to there has to be a basis in the language. And if you make up some new language, you know, good luck. That's more like just making up a religion. So in the end, the religion came back to this saying, you know, they better have some cash flow and there better be, you better know where all the shares are held and you better know who owns them and you better, or else you're the sucker in the room. So the faster you learn the language, and you can learn the language by following smart people like JC or all these people, and they did this for 20 years. Now it's easier to follow those smart people and find them and kind of, I call it more like a Peloton, like in a cycling race. The more you can draft behind smart people, not copy them, right? You know, you go find those great white sharks that break down everything, and then just follow behind them. And the scraps that you're going to pick up mm-hmm. are incredible. Just let them be who they are, and you just build your own little knowledge peloton, and you're going to learn the language much faster. And once you learn the language of markets and really understand your risk profile, you're set for life. So the faster you invest that 5 to 6 years, maybe 10 years, learning this language on your own, what an investment. Mm. What an incredible investment that people can make.
5 to 6 years, guys, not 5 to 6 months or 5 to 6 weeks. Or,
and by the way, if you really have the right attitude about 5 to 6 years or 10 years, in your 40th year, you're competing against the people that have 4 months of experience. It's all your money. That's right. Basically, they're giving your money. Whereas if you learn Spanish 40 years later, you have no, I don't understand why they teach that in school, because learning Spanish today has no extra benefit in 40 years versus learning the language of money in the markets today has exponential benefits the older you get. Mm. Warren Buffett made 90% of his net worth after he was like 60. Right? So it's like, imagine following Warren's teachings. I'm not a Warren Buffett fan, but like, imagine being able to like learn in your 20s everything he now knows in his 90s.
Right.
And now and it's another thing Jim O'Shaughnessy calls people time billionaires. When you're in your 20s, you're a time billionaire. I'm 58, so I'm in like a time thousandaire at this point. Like every decision is like, I'm going to be dead by the time this works. Versus your 20s, it's like you're a time billionaire. So you want to be learning this stuff in your 20s while you're a time billionaire.
I mean, the way that you're discussing trading and investing to me is, it's really entrepreneurial the way you're talking about it, because I break finance, and I even started this conversation, I broke finance and entrepreneurship into two categories, because I feel like would-be entrepreneurs, people that want to go out and express their ideas and make a lot of money, they get lured into the quick buck of finance and trading. Or they, like me, go work on Wall Street for fucking 7 or 8 years when they should have been doing something else. And they either get chewed up and spit out, or they feel like they don't learn anything. And it's just this misguided thing. But the way that you're describing it, it makes me feel, I think it's the right way to describe it. It's, hey, this is an entrepreneurial learning experience, just like opening up a burger restaurant down the street or a steakhouse or a coffee shop. It is a constant iterative experience, and you're going to need to learn, and you're going to need to do. You can't go to the weekend seminar and come back from the weekend seminar and you're Paul Tudor Jones. It's just not going to happen. In my book, The Entrepreneurship Field Guide, I kind of like go after trading and finance because they say it inappropriately sucks up a lot of the smartest people in the market. But really, I think the message is, if you're going to put in the work and you're going to put in the open-mindedness that you would have put in to build your tech product or your restaurant or coffee shop, whatever, and you're going to put that into trading, investing, you're going to be successful, but it's going to take a fucking long time. There is no quick buck.
There's always a quick buck. It's just, I don't know the odds of you
keeping it.
First making it, and then the idea that you think you're going to be, the odds of you keeping it is way.
I've rarely kept the quick ones.
So it's a habit thing, right? So I can give people tips on how to get started, right? They don't need 10 screens. They don't need to follow a lot of people. They should really understand their risk profile, but they should start. The reason I invested in Robinhood right away and I just knew it was a home run idea was not because I couldn't foresee everything, but I said, the idea that kids could quickly build a watch list on their phone and buy one share or half a share was just, that was the idea. Meaning, until Robinhood came along, look at that coffee. It was a miniature coffee cup.
Espresso.
I
don't mess around. I don't mess around with big cups around here, Howard.
Well, you know what they say with people with little cups?
I know very well. There's an inverse correlation, Howard.
According to you, that's just bad information.
The market. It's my show, baby.
the idea that it is the most entrepreneurial thing that you can do is to learn how to invest. One of the greatest freedoms that America has, as corrupt as the markets are, is the markets, right? And I think the faster your parents or your teachers or your friends get you to open an account that has low commission trading or zero commission trading, the better. Does that mean that you put all your money in it? No. But the idea that you could go for $20 and own 8 stocks on Robinhood and have a diversified portfolio, you can hate on them for everything they've ever done. But the fact that that gift is available to people and you could be in business and learn the markets with $10, $20, $100 is maybe the greatest freedom of one of the greatest freedoms that Web2 ever gave us. You know, we got Uber, Airbnb, and we have Stripe, and we have Venmo. But like Robinhood and the copycats that allow you to take $100 and get started at learning a language, and that you have the social web to like find people to like mentor behind, is like absolute nirvana. If people aren't going to do it, you can lead a horse to what you, if people aren't going to do this, it's crazy. The fact that that they're not teaching this in schools is mandatory, how to like manage your money and learn how to make money off growing companies, off the idea of growth, is one of our great failures of education. But now that people like you and YouTubers and podcasts exist and Robinhood and StockTwits and all these great products, Vanguard, it's kind of a sin as an American not to take advantage of this stuff.
I think perhaps what like younger listeners don't realize is how hard it was to trade a stock 10, 15 years ago. You just would end up not doing it, right? So it was left to the practitioners and to rich families, and you know, your rich grandma had a account open. And now it's with, like you said, fractional trading. You don't even need any money to get in the game and start playing and learning. And that's a huge, it's a huge benefit that, quite frankly, you, if you're 18 years old, you're 25, you probably don't even realize how much of a game changer. So in entrepreneurship language, really what we're saying is speed to market. You get to market in 10 minutes now. Whereas it would have you'd have to go to the brokerage. You'd have to meet John. John would have to sit you down, and you couldn't open an account with $20. It'd laugh you out the door. You know, now you're doing it from the comfort of your parents' house, basically. And you have the information to learn, and then you hopefully invest a small amount of money and start learning. So if you have $100, you're 18 years old, you're 25 years old, right? And you're saying, all right, I want to start learning. I've got $100. What do you do? What are the steps that you take?
Well, today I would say own the QQQ, and you know, tech is growth. You know, tech now is in medicine and healthcare. So tech is now permeated to the point where like owning 100 stocks is plenty. And so you might as well own the 100 largest tech companies, you know, globally. So I would start there, not the S&P. I would start with just dollar cost average every month. If you wanted to get cute about it, I would say, okay, there's 7 huge companies that everybody knows: Tesla, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google. Pick 5 of those and pick one wildcard product that you use every day. It could be a fashion company, it could be an auto company, it could be, you know what I mean? And just be, you know, just don't be too fancy, but just start. That would be the thing. Time in the market is all that matters. You're a time billionaire. The markets are rigged to go up. Okay,
right.
They just are, because the way everybody wants to make money, at least they're rigged to go up. And they're rigged to go up in a way that the best companies, the biggest companies, work. And it's just a positive expectancy thing based on profits. You know, the world is driven by profits, at least the American world is driven by profits. If that breaks, we have much bigger problems. Like if the idea, there's no defense against that. We're all on our own at that point. Maybe you own Bitcoin because you need to travel to Argentina, which becomes the new America, but I can't predict that. In a world that is driven, America is driven by corporate profits. In that world, time in the market is what matters. It's rigged, and it's rigged in your favor if you own the best companies.
It's rigged in a couple ways, right? America happens to keep growing and being innovative, so you've got growth on your side, and you've got inflation on your side, right? So you've got growth plus inflation. Basically, they're going to keep printing money, and a lot of that money that gets printed goes to buy more financial shit, right? So when we talk about owning indexes, I feel like the 18-year-old in me is groaning. Ah, that sounds so boring. And it's like, well, you know, this is like walking into a casino and just, you know, having a little counter on the roulette wheel. Like, you have an advantage when it comes to owning a chunk of the market because of growth and inflation. And by the way, growth, if it stagnates, you still have inflation for the most part. To me, well, that's the way human, I look at it. Mm-hmm.
And human ingenuity, like, humans just get smarter. Like, what do we, you know, barring a world war, which right. again, I can't predict, but barring a world war, humans use their ingenuity to grow, not to build weapons and shoot each other. So if we're not shooting each other, betting against humans is stupid. Humans will solve problems. They always do.
Solve mostly every problem.
Every problem.
So far.
So good. Without world war, you cannot bet against the market.
Yeah.
Now, if you believe in world war, I get it. Put your money in T-bills and Bitcoin,
and hang
that's
on.
Still an investment strategy, but it's fine. That's a choice that you have, but generally that's just not the smartest. Historically, that hasn't been a smart thing to do.
What's your stance on crypto right now? Where's your head at when it comes to crypto and Bitcoin? And I don't know if you play there.
It depends where you're. I've done well because I own Bitcoin and I'm an investor in ETO. So indirectly, I own a lot of crypto through my investments. Probably too much, because we don't need that much. But I think it's very interesting because it's scarce. Bitcoin is scarce and it's software. And the price action, meaning it's supposed to be zero based on everything I've ever read.
Hmm.
Like, you know, it's a beanie baby. It's this. It's not really gold. So after 14 years, shouldn't it be zero? Like, you know, everybody's taking a shot at this thing. The other fascinating thing about Bitcoin and then Ethereum is that they're kind of the opposite type products. So they have different, you know, use cases. One's fully decentralized. One's pretty much centralized. And they both solve different problems right now. And the other thing is both aren't securities, even according to the SEC. So they are forms of money. Which is fascinating. The kids get to grow up and they don't have to just buy US dollars. If they really hate America and really think America's going to the shitter, there is a bet. You can really hide your money off the grid in Bitcoin and put it in storage and move and have money. That's pretty amazing. You don't have to take a candelabra and sell it in Argentina. You can take your, you know what I mean? Like, that is an amazing thing. And yeah. Just for that, it's fascinating to me. In terms of everything else, I don't need anything else that crypto offers because I live in America and I'd rather invest my money in things that have profits.
Meaning pay attention to the two biggest products, coins, and everything else is just noise because we have such better options with more intrinsic value and upside.
Yeah, I can't. If a lot of young people got the get rich, I get it. Like, that's in 99, it was the internet. In 08, it was mortgages. And in 2020, it was Discord rooms and crypto, get rich quick.
Right.
It's fascinating. But in the end, the American government and the markets reward corporate profits.
That's how it's set up. I'm curious to see how crypto is handled as we move forward in the future.
Super bullish. I just not the guy that's going to be able to tell you the future there.
Yeah, I worry about I think that when you start to, I think government, at least here in the US, I think any interaction that they could have with Bitcoin and Ethereum, it's tampering with freedom. I think we should be able to freely transact in these markets. And I get worried when I see, you know, them creating competing products, you know, the U.S. digital dollar. I do not look forward to a day that is a competing or mandated product that I need to now buy in order to transact. That to me is a encroaching on my freedom. I think crypto, whether you love it or you hate it, you don't want to stamp it out. It is a form of freedom, intellectual, and commerce and all the things that we love.
Well, they can't stamp it out. They, first of all, if you own Bitcoin and on a drive, it's already yours. In case, unless you forget your password, there's no free lunch. You still got to remember your password, and you better not lose it. So that's the only cost is your mental cost of like, oh my God, do I, you know, it's like your iPhone. Do I have it with me? So they can infringe on that. That's why I'm fascinated by Bitcoin. You know, like as a Jewish person, you know, we were educated on the Holocaust growing up. We saw people carrying all their goods in a running away from home with a suitcase with their jewelry or their gold. This is at its basis case, that's what Bitcoin is, and that's valuable. Mm. Now, hopefully no one ever needs it. So what are you willing to put there that it just in case? That's about what its value is right now. That's pretty valuable in the right scenario. So if you live in Argentina, it's worth way more to you than it is in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, having spent some time in Argentina and used the illegal cuevas and the dólar blue and all the backroom dealings and the crisp hundreds, if your hundred has a fold in it, it's worth $90. It's, I mean, you do not want to find yourself in that type of market, and you bet your ass that if I was living down there, which, you know, thankfully I'm not because of the economic situation, I would have a stack of hard drives instead of a stack of
Bitcoin already won. Bitcoin already won. There's very few brands, well, no brand. Pepsi owns 50% of the brand, Coke 40%. Or there's very few brands. Think about the brand of Bitcoin. There's no employees, no marketing budget. And pretty much you go around the world, and after 14 years, everybody's heard of it. It's like Jesus at this point, or Moses, right? Like, it's a religion at some point, but it also has one utility, which is, like, if you handle it properly, it has value.
And it's transferable, and it's relatively anonymous. I don't want to say there's... I'm not smart enough to know.
I'm not going to get into the... That's smart. I can't comment on the tech. But the price action makes me believe that it's going to be around for a very long time.
And how do you feel about, are you more of a Bitcoin guy or more of an Ethereum guy? Because I hear both cases. You just own a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't directly own Ethereum. I have some funds and stuff that own it. It just not bought in.
Yeah, I don't know the specific differences between the two, other than I think speed and the energy that goes into the whole process, the amount of waste supposedly Bitcoin creates versus Ethereum. But I don't know. I actually don't end up having a lot of these crypto discussions. So this is interesting. I think I like the idea of calling it an insurance policy on your portfolio and a relatively cheap one.
So cheap, depending on, and way more efficient than gold.
Heck of a lot lighter than gold. If you're carrying something across the border in your suitcase going overseas. One thing I wanted to touch on, right, is to go jump from finance and to put on your VC cap, but specifically around like behavior. Is there a certain set of behavior, you know, because this is the really rich podcast. I have a belief system that you act a certain way and good shit just starts to happen to you. Is there a certain behavior that you look for from founders? Is there a certain behavior that you sit down and you try to test when you're deciding who or what to invest in? I looked at your portfolio, and I mean, there's a handful of companies in there that I really love and believe in. And it appears as though that behavior seeps through their newsletters and their, you know, their marketing materials. But I'm curious to hear, is that something that you analyze? Are you?
I mean, it's a people business, right? You know, we're betting on people. And so what makes the ones the best? You know, I wish it was that easy, but you know, you're trying to line up as many things in your favor. It's just a game, and you're competing against everybody else who may be wanting to invest in that company at a certain rate of time. And it heats up and it cools down. Right now it's cold, so you have time to make decisions. You know, for a few years there, it was like you had an hour to make a decision, which was dumb. Mm. But you know, assuming you have the time to spend time with people, you want to spend as much time with who you're going to invest with without, you know, losing the deal. So you want to stretch the amount of time and see that person whether you're eating with them, seeing how they interact with their family, waiters, you know, other employees. But it's a people-based business. So can they recruit? Meaning that's a very important thing. They're the CEO has one job, not to run out of money and to recruit and build a good product. So if you're going to hand over $1 million or $2 million at the highest risk stage of a thing, you want to, you're partners with that person. And it's going to be a 10-year partnership. You know, even, you know, Robinhood, eToro has been 14 years. Robinhood's 8 years to some kind of exit. So 8 years, a long time.
Sure.
I don't even know if marriages last that long on average, right? So these are marriages. So you got to spend as much time with the person. Can that person, are they a good steward of capital? Are they, but the key things that make a founder great is domain experience, right? Like in this world, you know, it's very sexy to say I backed Mark Zuckerberg, and it's very sexy to say I backed an 18-year-old or a 15-year-old. But really, I want to back people that have domain experience because they have something that's incredibly stressful to them or has bothered them. And it's just, they want to fix it. They have the unique understanding of an industry and they're pissed and they have an idea that's solvable. It doesn't have to be, there's no way I know if it's going to be for 10 million people or 500,000 people at the beginning or 100 million people. So that's, I don't know if you can solve for that. And generally the best companies, even like Uber or Robinhood, they never at the beginning look like they're going to be for everybody. So really there's a lot of people that are false prophets right now. You know, they worked at Facebook or they worked at LinkedIn and they think they're geniuses, but it was the product and the era that made them geniuses,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm more like serendipitous about this, saying, listen, I did Robinhood, I've done some great companies, eToro and StockTwits, but really when they started, they weren't for 10 billion people or 10 million people. They were for 100 people.
Mm.
And we just got lucky that there was a bigger data set. Now, but VCs will talk about TAM, total addressable market. We want there to be TAM, but if the total addressable market is apparent to everybody in the room, is it really, that means everybody's gonna be in that industry. So I'll give you an example today, like pickleball. Pickleball, it's, who would have predicted it? But now let's look at it in where it's at today. It's now a proven fastest growing sport of all time. Do I want to invest in pickleball? No, personally, because everybody's investing in pickleball because it's so apparent to everybody that there's millions of pickleball players. So I'm not saying that's a bad idea. I'm just saying I prefer to find things that are apparent to enough people that it could work. But when you prove that this product does work, way more people for it existed than before. So with Manscaped, which is one of our companies, you know, ball shaving company,
yep.
Who would have I knew as when I met the founder and he told me the thing, I giggled and I was like, man, I was manscaping myself. And I'm not even the market that it's supposed to be for people to shave their balls, you know, guys, you know, when they're going on dates. I knew it was a trend, but if I asked my son, does he shave his balls? He's 20. He's not going to tell me that he shaves his balls. So I was getting like I was not even getting, but I knew.
You're like, Dad, come on, man. Like, just
right.
Leave me
I
alone.
I remember asking my nephews and all these, they all lied to me because they weren't going to tell me they shaved their balls. Right?
Looking at Manscaped's revenue, there's, you know,
yes,
a lot of liars out there.
In revenue. So there's a lot of balls. It turns out there's a lot of balls that need shaving. But I knew as a 55-year-old man at the time who was shaving, not necessarily but just my ear and my chest.
Sure, you were taking care of yourself. You were grooming
taking
yourself.
Taking care of myself. I was grooming. And so I knew if you build it and you do this marketing, wow, that the balls are out there. So it was obvious to me.
Okay, the balls
now,
are
he
out
still
there.
Had to execute. He's turned out to be an incredible marketer. And what we got right about him was that he was just a fierce marketing guy. He didn't get hung up on the tech. He didn't get hung up on, you know, making everybody a convert. He just knew that if he built this product and shipped it and did funny marketing, and that's all him.
Brilliant.
So that's marketing. Robinhood was different. It was like I played with the product. You know, when they showed it to me, and I knew just by looking at the product, if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. Meaning, just focus on delivering that basic thing, and that will do it. I didn't even think they needed to offer free commissions. I just thought it was so ingenious to have this intuitive, simple interface to swipe and buy a stock that, from my knowledge of stock twits and my knowledge of Twitter and my knowledge of, you know, social media and brokerage and everything I knew, I said, if you build this and it's legal, millions of people will use it. And I will bring you 50,000 of my people that will just, they can't wait to see this.
Right.
So sometimes they just, the tea leaves line up, but generally it's the person. Do they have domain experience? And if they see something that everybody else doesn't see, and I wish it was like easy, but it just isn't. And only, no matter, I've been doing this for 20 years and it's still like 6 out of 10. Like the minute I write the check, I'm like, what was I thinking? You know, even though I'm supposedly good at it, right? Because people are, they trick you, right? Like they, you know, it's just like a blind date, right? Like, so, if, you know, it's a complicated dance. And, but generally we know pretty early because it's just that founder just has that special understanding of working hard and being a good salesman and hiring and being able to raise money and storytelling. Like the best founders are good storytellers.
What are things that founders can do to screw up this entire process and not get anything, not get a buck? You said, hey, how do they treat a server in a restaurant? What are things that they can do that just blows up the whole deal?
So many things.
Let's hear a few.
It's like Seinfeld at this point, right? Like, it's like if you watch Seinfeld, it's like the opposite, right? Like everybody all day, all they did was things to like upset people. It's, you'd be surprised how, I don't know. It's a good question, but an obvious question, but not one that's easy to answer. It's just everything's different. It's just generally, you just get this vibe, you know? And again, if you're going to do a check like we did during COVID and you're only going to meet the person over Zoom, this is why the failure rate's just going to end up being miserable.
Right. You don't have enough, yeah. You don't have enough signal. You don't see the soft side of things.
It shouldn't be surprising that was like going to be the worst return profile, like 2020 to 2023, because so many bad behaviors in my industry. You had too much money. Yeah. Everybody was entitled. Prices were too high and you had no real, you didn't know who you were doing business with. You only saw the top of their, you don't even know. I could have 1-inch legs and be so offensive to people, even though I didn't mean to be. Like, how could you possibly know anything about me by just seeing a headshot?
So this is about character. I mean, in a sense, right?
Pick up, you can't read someone's character in a Zoom.
I know I can't. That's why I try to shoot this live as much as possible, because the conversation, it's just, number one, it's the benefit of me actually getting to hang out with cool people like yourself, but it's the conversation just goes into a special place. It's almost, you enter that flow state a lot quicker.
Yeah, and that's why I've done a podcast for 3 years with people. It's not so much to build an audience, it's just to build my network. And
it's fun.
Yeah. It's very low cost and it's, you know, get good conversations. I'm open to doing it with people that are smart, but you know, there's not much you get out of these other than network and good, and you'd be able to think through my thoughts. It's really important.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is, for me, it's a constant learning experience. I'm curious, like what, cause I know what my character attributes are that I look for when I, whether I'm on the Zoom or I'm in a restaurant, I'm looking for people who actually genuinely care about what I'm doing and want to help. And that's very easy when you have a little bit of time to talk about it, right? Where you say, hey, I want to buy myself more time to meet you and to sit with you, because the truth will be revealed eventually, one way or another. For me, it's that passion and that belief, you know, if I'm hiring someone for my team in social media, that they actually care and are a fan of the material and believe in what I'm doing, that is so pinnacle. And then it's quickly the humility. I look for humility, understanding that you know very, very little, and understanding that you'll be wrong, and the having the open-mindedness and the willingness to change when new information comes into the equation. I think if you have passion and humility, and you're kind to people, because kindness, in my opinion, promotes creativity and open-mindedness, and it's the grease of society, then you've got the triple threat. Notice how I didn't say Harvard or Stanford or, you know, anything in
I have more of a beef with Harvard. I think, listen, I wrote about this a few, like maybe last month, we've just reached this peak level of low humility. There's just so little humility for whatever reason. You know, I think maybe hope I'm wrong. I always say these things where I hope I'm wrong. And it's just my take. But I think part of it was ZIRP, you know, zero interest rate. Part of it was COVID. Part of it was Facebook. You know, this growth, this miracle era of 2006 to 2000, whenever YouTube and LinkedIn, this miracle era of 2006 that ended in 2020, where growth just was bananas. You know, the cloud, you had zero interest rates, you had governments printing money, you had easy to grow on Facebook or YouTube or Twitter. They didn't know how to monetize. They hadn't figured out what to price a lead, right? So you could just pillage Twitter for leads as we did with StockTwits. You know, we were trying to help Twitter. They didn't know how to help themselves because they were growing. So everybody was growing and there was this free flywheel. So everybody then started thinking they were smart. That's where the humility stopped. And then that became ego and hubris, and you had Uber, and you had all these founders that just thought they were, you know, the shit. Mm-hmm. And people that left Facebook that really didn't have much experience other than they worked at Facebook, and they didn't really know what growth. They took credit for the growth that really just came because of the era.
Right.
And so now we have to clean all that up. So, you know, we see it in podcast. I make fun of the all-in podcast guys often, but because they're the poster boys of this. They're not that they're dumb or that they're mean. It's just they're very good at one thing, which is self-promotion, traffic. They're just very good at marketing. And so that is a skill. And they're not dumb, but they are taking a lot of credit that isn't theirs, right? And they are tricking people. They're a modern version of a huckster like Tony Robbins and promoters, and it's no different. It's just a digital era version of it, and they're smart, so you can follow them, but you better really dig into who these people are before you follow their advice. And but you got to know how to read the room and how to deal with all this stuff. So I think this 14-year period of free growth is over. And you better, if you're going to invest in a consumer product, it better be a guy that, like Paul, that runs Manscaped, who understands marketing and really understands how to grow. But all this fake growth or all this organic growth that we saw, which was just a miracle, it was just a 14-year miracle, is now over because Apple and Google really control the pipes. And you don't own. It's going to, you know, if you're counting on them to build your business, you better be prepared for them to squeeze you at the worst possible time. So we have new overlords. And so we live in a new world of who our rulers are. And they're better than the old rulers, but they're driven by profit. And they're going to be ruthless about that. And I prefer these rulers to the old rulers, but they're just as evil in many ways.
Who are the new rulers right now of the market? Who are the new rulers where we've got to play their games? Are we talking about OpenAI? Who are we talking about now?
No, I'm not into OpenAI. Is cool, but it's Apple and Google at the top because they control the app stores. And then at some rule, it's Facebook. If you rely on Facebook, they're your ruler for growth. And if you rely on Amazon, if they see you're doing well, they may build the product themselves. Just be careful of just know that if you're building on someone else's platform, you're their bitch, and that they don't be surprised when they stab you in the back.
Right.
And so that's why Bitcoin and Ethereum are somewhat interesting, is that these are more open protocols that eventually will, we're not there yet, but that's the promise, is that they won't bite you. But right now the government will bite you. So it's just not, the air is much different right now, because this, everybody battling to win, to be the Apple or Google, well, that race is over.
It's almost like we're describing, you know, the zero interest rate environment was life on easy mode or moderate mode, and now we're back to life on hard mode. So if you are, you know, if you really don't, you aren't the leader in your domain, you aren't the expert that you say you are, we're going to find out pretty fucking fast.
Yeah, money's expensive. Time is getting more expensive. Growth is more expensive. But that's great because it'll weed out all the fluff much quicker. Like, you can't have it both ways. Like, it was fun. Like, if you didn't make money from 2006 to 2020, you, unfortunately, I don't know what happened to you. Now, if you made a lot of money, doesn't mean you were that smart, because it was, now there's people taking credit for being smart. That's what I'm worried about. And
I see.
That's what we have to be careful of right now, is these people selling that they were smart because they made money between 2006 and 2020. You, if you didn't make money, I'm more worried about that person. If you did make money, I'm still wary of you because you were supposed to make money.
Right, right. Right, the base case was pulling something off.
The base case was a unicorn. Right? Like, that is no longer going to be the base case.
Wow.
The base case is going to be, can you build a profitable business?
Right.
And can you do it with the least amount of people possible?
Sure.
The new base case is, you know what's cool? Instagram was cool. There was a moment in time when Instagram, we were so close to nirvana in 2011 because Instagram with 10 employees sold for $1 billion. That, for a moment, was the roadmap for this new. So we are not going to go back to that moment. People need to start thinking about what made WhatsApp and Instagram cool. They forced Facebook to pay $1 billion and $20 billion for a no-revenue business. And that was what was so exciting about 2011 and 2020. But because of Zerp, and because Facebook was evil in the sense that they went to WhatsApp and they went to Instagram and said, if you don't sell to us because you have no revenue, because you're our bitch, because you need our platform to monetize, we will squeeze you. So they had to sell. Okay. And so they actually did the right thing by selling because they had no choice. But the real promise is, and that's what crypto comes back into, the real promise is if Instagram had been built on Solana or Ethereum, theoretically, they wouldn't have been able to be shut down by Facebook. And they could have been 10 people. So like Midjourney, which is an AI company, which is built on Discord, because the product's so unique, people are paying. Midjourney is a very profitable company with very few people. That's the goal. What entrepreneurs should be focused on is not how much money you can raise, but on how little money you could raise to become a $1 billion company. That's what impresses me today. Okay.
Amen.
And we were almost there in 2011, but Zerp and Facebook and, you know, the game just didn't play out the way it was supposed to be. So you need to take the Instagram playbook and the WhatsApp playbook. That would impress me. And build a business. And you know what's cool? Building a $1 billion company that's profitable with 10 employees. That's fucking cool. Like what Mr. Beast has done. Now, I'm not saying that's easy, but that's cool.
Well, it's a lot easier than it was because you don't need 100 salespeople when you can create AI tech or use fastoutreach.ai or whatever, like to build out an outbound pipeline. It's cheaper to get out there. You can do all sorts of different tricks and copywriting and things that would take you hours that now take you 30 minutes. So you really don't have an excuse to get your idea off the ground, because now you can get it off faster with less and less people than ever before. And I love that you said it's not who can raise the most money. It's, hey, guys, let's build something that actually makes revenue. Because
and doesn't need me. You know what you want to be is, you know what's cool? Not raising VC money.
Bootstrapping. Yeah.
I don't even like the word. It's, you know what's cool? Not raising money.
Well, bootstrapping makes you sound like a heathen. You know what I mean?
Bootstrapping is like, I came from Brooklyn and I hate VCs. You know, building a business is just cool. Saying bootstrapping makes me wary of the person.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we need a new word because it's a shitty marketing tool.
Just building a great business.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the way that I think, because I never came up through the Silicon Valley machine. I never went the VC route. Like the way that I think is your business has to make money, and then you use a little bit of that money to buy a burger every now and then and put the rest back into the business. That's the way
that's why investing is the most entrepreneurial thing. You can do it for very low cost, And you can do it from anywhere in the world, and you don't need employees. I mean, could you think of a more entrepreneur? And you can build an edge by learning it and following the smartest people in the world and reading the market in a different way. I mean, hedge funds were the original. Before the internet, hedge funds were the business. That was the most entrepreneurial business you could have, because it could have two people. And if you could prove that you could beat the market, you could manage billions of dollars. Talk about entrepreneurial. Now you can be a hedge fund of YouTube. Meaning you can arb the most amount of traffic and do the most creative things and build this huge business just making good videos and learning how to play the algorithm. Right. The risk is you're still in YouTube's bitch, but at least there's a model there for a low, you don't have to hire 100 people to get there.
Right.
So I myself went to Arizona State University and was born in Toronto, so I didn't have the regular path. So I don't think that ever mattered. I'm not saying Harvard people or Stanford people aren't smart, but that's a misdirection. That's over too. Like to think that you don't have to go to Harvard unless you want to be an investment banker. And God bless you. If you want to be an investment banker, good. One less person I have to compete with. You want to be a lawyer? Good. AI is coming for you. You want to be an accountant? Good. AI is coming for you. You know what's cool? Being a tradesman, having a skill, being able to make a business that cash flows is cool. Those are in low demand, and you didn't have to go to Stanford to do that. You didn't even have to go to college. You know what you need to know? You need to know how to use Shopify. You need to know how to look people in the eye. You need to know and be willing to travel. You need to be willing to use these platforms. You need to be able to write a journal. You need to be able to like network socially. You don't need any of those education. You don't need any of those things. And by the way, you don't even need an engineering degree. You can do no code. So an AI. So like technology solving every excuse that an entrepreneur would have,
yeah.
Which is like my whole point of like betting against that is crazy, because indirectly we're all solving for the problem. Engineers are putting themselves out of business at this point because they should. They were never worth 500 grand a year, you know? And so right now I would say if you were going to have one skill, it would be marketing. And no one's taken a marketing class in 20 years.
Right? Well, right? It's everyone goes marketing. I don't want to be broke for the rest of my life. I gotta go work for Goldman Sachs.
I need fucking marketers is what I need. And no one has that skill. You know what marketing was for 14 years? How do I buy a Facebook ad? Oh, okay, if it works, I'll buy 10 more of those ads.
It's so painful to hear. Shit.
Yeah, it goes to like even the markets. What is in least demand? For years, it was like, why would I need to do a billboard? Why would I need to do a TV ad? Why would I need to do something like that catches people's attention?
Right.
And now that matters.
I mean, my word is creativity. If you're creative, you can move from idea to doing or output faster now than ever before. So even the laziest mofos on planet Earth are getting shit done now, where they might have not gotten started 10 years ago. And we love that because that's ingenuity. And if you're owning a piece of the market, well, you're benefiting from that too.
It's time for the creative people to make money. You know, and the creative people have spent 30 years on stage doing stand-up comedy before they got discovered. I'm not saying they deserve to be rich overnight, but like we're entering an era of where the creative people has never had a better opportunity to not be a slave for 30 years. Now, they still have to learn to use the tools and they still have to look people in the eyes and they still have to practice their trade. But this will be the era of creatives for sure. And that's why I say marketing, but like any person that can think outside the box and has a good work ethic and knows how to use the tools is just so far ahead of everybody else. And which I would say, don't go to school, just practice these trades.
Well, because everything you just rallied off, you're better off learning on YouTube than you are at Harvard. Because what you're learning in Harvard is already old.
That's a network. You can build that same network on Twitter. Just be nice to people and find, just why do you need to go to Harvard? Signals to me that you just don't know what the hell's going on.
Well, the same thing happened. So I graduated in 2008 from Cornell, right? So I was in that kind of machine and in that mindset, and I went right into it. And the guys that didn't get a job on Wall Street, because it was the worst fucking time ever to get a job on Wall Street, arguably, They went in and just said, I'll go to grad school. I'll go, even though they didn't want to, it was, I don't know what to do. I don't want to look like an idiot. So I'll go to grad school. And a lot of folks, you know, that I know, they didn't get started for another, you know, 3, 4, 5 years in their career. It was a huge amount of time that they spent, you know, let's be honest, drinking beer just with bigger kids at another expensive grad school. And now they're doing something that they might not even like anyway.
Tarek, I love school. So, but it was different. There was no internet. And so I don't begrudge people that go to Harvard or stay work there. That was their goal. I mean, I don't begrudge them, but it's no longer the be all end all. And it shouldn't be. And parents need to do a better job of like understanding this stuff.
Mm.
So a lot of this is on the parents. Parents are not doing their job.
To just provide some options for kids.
Or just explain to them the reality. Like everybody's trying to protect their kids and they should be letting their kids live.
Because ultimately a kid that becomes enterprising in a digital world is bulletproof compared to someone who becomes specialized from a fancy university.
Yeah, and curious. I don't know if you can breed it, but...
That's good.
I mean, if you're not curious, you just the world is stacked against you. That's just sad, but that's just... It's just never been more true. Curious people do better. So however figure that out, I haven't studied it because luckily my kids are pretty curious, but... So I don't know. I just didn't take it seriously at the time, but the gift is curiosity.
How would you build? I want to end on this because this is something that I have my own view here, and I collect all the DMs. How would you? Let's pretend you're an entrepreneur, a young entrepreneur. You want to maybe you want to invest. Maybe you want to build a coffee shop. Maybe you want to build a digital business. What's your toolkit right now? What are the tools that you say, hey, this is my my quick start kit.
Well, my quick start kit is my portfolio, right? Manscaped. I don't know, have clean balls. And if you're a woman, I don't know how to talk to women. So it's like, I can't advise women. But if you're a guy, shave your balls. Like you never know. And clean underwear. I don't have an underwear investment, but clean underwear. although Manscaped has underwear as well. So get yourself a Manscaped kit. The second thing is open a Robinhood account or any free brokerage account and get 10 stocks going or SPY or QQQ. So there's two easy things you can do. Third thing, start writing. If it's Facebook, if it's Instagram, if it's Twitter, TikTok, just start contributing content. Don't worry about how many people follow you, but just develop your voice. And best time to develop your voice is when no one's following you. So don't worry. So don't even share it. Just you can do it on a private, you know, chat. But start writing your thoughts down and keeping yourself accountable. And then I think the next thing, if you can afford it, get a coach, whether it's a psychiatrist or a psychologist or, you know, I don't think enough young people pay for mentorship. If your parents are going to help you with anything, get a coach to get inside your head and help you like break down barriers, a professional. And that's hard, but that's something important. I think that barrier is coming down with mental health and kids and apps. I think kids want this and they don't want to wait 3 weeks for an appointment. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, like there's a lot of tools out there right now. So I would do that, but get people in your corner. And if you have to pay for them, pay for them. Get your people around you that are helping like teach you things. And then, you know, find mentors, you know, online or offline, like just ask for mentorship. And so, yeah, writing is key. We're investors in Beehive, which is a fast growing newsletter product.
I use Beehive for my newsletter.
It's amazing. Yeah. So we were the first investors there. So we generally try and invest in those companies that we use as platforms. So, you know, Robinhood and Beehive, we're really proud of. Stock Twits, where you can journal, but Twitter. And we're constantly looking, you know, Coifin for researching stocks, which is an incredible product. But yeah, you need to go get that peloton around you. And you got to develop your expertise. So even if it's such a narrow thing like golf or gardening, you can make a fortune, but you have to start understanding your industry and where it's going and like fashion and technology and be the expert.
Build out your, the way that I'm hearing this, it's build out your sandbox, build out your playground, right? Like I'm putting in a gym in my house because I work out, what, 5 days a week. I'm always working out. Well, why don't I have a gym in my house? I don't have a good answer to that question. So that's where we're putting a gym in the house. It's build out your sandbox and your toolkit so you can play and you can learn as easily and hopefully as affordably and cheaply as possible. And I think what you mean by, you know, right, I never thought about it like this, but you're refining your voice and your personal brand, which is one of those things that you're investing in yourself that ultimately 5 years down the road will be this monster marketing asset for you.
I've been writing almost daily for 17 years, but
wow.
It's not any one post that's worked. It's the deposits that you make, right? It's very inflationary right now to like create content because you're competing, but you can't, but if you don't start, it's going to get more inflationary tomorrow.
Right. Yeah.
So the sooner you start making deposits, whether it's in your bank account or in your creativity and accountability, the better.
Howard Lindzen, man. Thanks for coming on. This was awesome.
Deep.
This was deep, dude.
Deep.
I love it, man. I hope to meet you in real life and not just this.
No,
fucking,
no one's ever met me. This is just all a myth. I'm Vitalik from Ethereum.
You're
no
full
one's
of
ever
shit.
Met me. I am full of shit. That's maybe the truthiest thing said on this podcast.
Look, man, I appreciate your time and hope to see you again soon.
All right. Cheers.
Bye-bye.